Isn't today great? Today is such a great day. Everything is so great.
We're going to have a lot of fun. We got some wonderful people for you.
All you mommies and daddies out there who complain to the radio station, I got something to say to you.
And the first thing you've got to do is say the call letters properly. Okay?
It's an incredible metamorphosis of love and emotion and sensitivity and tenderness and fun and joy and happiness.
Did you know that this show represents health and hope?
Day for lively conversation on the Amy Beth Berkley Show, weaving together a mosaic of voices from the arts, pop culture, personal growth, and justice. How are you? I know you got lots to say about lots of things. We'll take on the cultural cacophony in measured doses. More walks in the creative woods, including my travails and your inspiration to action challenge success stories. Music as time permits, and a special guest. We will talk with author Lorraine Devon Wilkie about her phenomenal new book, The Alchemy of Noise. That's all coming up. I'd love to get you in the mix, too. Are you listening live? It is Tuesday, April 23rd, 2 o'clock out west, 4 p.m. Central, 5 o'clock here in the east. Our number of motion, 347-857-4505. Hey, Twitter, you know, is 24/7, so live or on podcast, dive in when it works for you at AB Writes. If you are joining us for the live broadcast, more and more folks do it each time. I love it. Avail yourself, along with the aforementioned, to the Facebook page and our PopNet chat box. It is all being helmed by our tenacious, talented Octopi from TCS, Trudy and Aurora in the booth, ML at headquarters. Show is brought to you in part by Old Navy. Celebrate the season with great styles and springtime savings at Old Navy. By Panera, the way food should be, now delivered. And our friends at PopNet. Arts, culture, and conversation on air, online, up and running 24/7, featuring select editions of the Amy Beth Arkley Show and those robust, occasionally raucous roundtables. We had one of those yesterday, did we not? More on that. Lots to talk about, but first let's welcome Lorraine to the show. Lorraine Devon Wilkie is the author of a few novels now. The latest just out, it's called The Alchemy of Noise. It is such a good, it's sort of ripped from the headlines with a lot of heart and soul about an interracial couple. It's a love story, tender, passionate, and fraught with our polarizing times. That's the backdrop. Lorraine, thank you for joining us. Hey, congratulations on the book, first of all.
Thank you. Well, thank you for having me. I'm delighted to be here. I enjoyed talking to you last time. And I'm enjoying our discussion about this new book, so I'm happy to be here.
Happy to have you here, indeed. It's a story, we should say, I don't want to give away too many of the particulars, but the basics are you have these two characters, Sidonie Frame and Chris Hawkins. They meet, they fall in love. She's a white woman, he's an African-American man, and, you know, there are a lot of, even in today's times, a lot of folks are still struggling with interracial romance and things they have to face that sometimes you don't think about you just don't think about it, but they do facing it even today. I mean, this is, you know, a story when you're reading it, you're like, well, gee, this could have been happening in the 1960s, but no, this is really what's going on with some of the things that people have to face. And talk about how you came to this story, and I know you struggled with the idea of even telling it, which I think is fascinating,
right.
This idea of cultural appropriation of stories, and I want to get your take on it, and I'll give you some of my insights on that or feelings about
sure.
it.
Sure.
Who gets to tell the story? I guess you struggled a little bit with that because you had to deal with some black characters. Tell us about that.
Well, yeah. Well, it's interesting. I was talking about this at my last book event. I actually wasn't, when I started writing the story, I wasn't, oddly, as aware of this trending debate about who gets to tell stories of race until I saw an article in the BBC, and it was about a very successful British writer, Anthony Horowitz, the article was about how he wanted to enter a black character into one of his novels, and his American agent said to him, "You cannot write a black character. That will not be accepted in America." And I was so shocked by that I then started doing some research and realized I was a little bit behind the curve on that particular trending debate. And this was after I'd written, you know, like my first draft. So I was sort of horrified and kind of decided, well, I need to do more studying about this. And I talked to a lot of people in the black community. I talked to a lot of artists. I did a lot of research. And I started writing my own perspective on it, which is, you know, I think the problem of disproportionate representation in the publishing industry or in any industry is definitely a real problem, and it's a real problem that needs to be solved. But I don't think we solve it by telling any writer of any culture or color or, you know, any orientation, gender, whatever, we don't solve it by telling them they can't include particular types of characters in their work. That's called censorship, and I don't believe that aids us in this quest to to open artistic conversation. But I do believe that if you are going to write outside your culture, you are obligated to do it right. And that requires research, that requires understanding, empathy, authenticity, sensitivity, and really doing your homework and really making sure you get it right, whether that's using sensitivity readers or interviewing people or having members of whatever group you're writing about that's outside your culture read your work and give you tips or, you know, feedback. And that's what I did. You know, I became very vigilant about it because the last thing I wanted was anybody to say, not only are you not allowed to do this, you've done it badly. I figure if I get some pushback on it, my answer is always going to be, read the book. If you think I got any of it wrong, let me know. But read the book first. And the you know, people within the Black community who have read the book have been very enthusiastic about it and have felt that I did get it right, and not only got it right, but as one person said, you've got racism 101 here for allies. It's a very important message because sometimes allies need to hear from their own group in order to really get what it is they might be missing. So
I'm glad you did it because I was just going to say, you know, first of all, it's a good read, so I'm glad you told it. I think my point is I'm so happy that you said I did my homework and all that, which is wonderful. I'm glad you did it. You took it very seriously. But also your impetus to tell the story, something in you wanted to tell that story. And stories come to those people who want to tell them, and you have a right to tell whatever story you want. And then, you want to get it right, of course, and do your homework on that. So you have both fronts covered. But you wanted to tell the story because you had a similar relationship at some point in your life years ago, right?
Well, that's how it, you know, that was the initial impetus of the story, which was back in the 80s, I was living in Los Angeles, where I still live. I was very immersed in the rock and roll scene, and I was in a relationship with a man of color. We lived together for 6 years, and whatever I thought I knew about racial inequity, the day-to-day existence of a Black man in America, whatever I thought I knew, my naivete was quickly disabused, because having that kind of proximity, which unless you are living with a Black person or somehow intimately involved with them in some way, and you're there with them day in and day out, I honestly do not believe whites can fully understand the Black experience, and I've written articles about that, because I don't think you get that. You looking through the filter of white privilege, I think it's very, very hard to get the day-to-day drip, 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 microaggressions, the small cuts of racism that Black people experience on a day-to-day basis. And so in this time that I was living with this man, it was a shocking experience for me. And I didn't know what at the time I wasn't thinking, oh, I'll write about this. But decades later, long after that relationship ended, I moved on to my life. Decades later, I started writing for the Huffington Post. And I was writing a lot of stories that were you know, social commentary and op-eds that were focused on what was going on in our culture, which was a lot of race conflict, and it was Obama's election and you know, Trayvon Martin and Ferguson and all of these issues. And I started as a way to kind of show that I had some idea that I brought into these articles some of my own experiences and got into a lot of very deep, provocative conversations with members of the Black community through phone calls and emails and social media comments and comments on the articles I was writing. And that dialogue, plus my own experience, plus I did a three-part interview series with this brilliant woman that I met as a response to one of my articles. Her name is Regina McRae. She's a Brooklyn-born, you know, owns her own bakery in Brooklyn. She's a BLM activist. She's a passionate, strong, powerful spokesperson for her culture. And I asked her if she would do a three-part series with me for HuffPost, which we did. And the rules were no holds barred. I can ask any question I want, and you can answer it any way you want. And that's when we began our dialogue. And she was so illuminating to me and brought so much to the table that was when I decided I'm going to write this book. I'm going to take all of this information that I've learned in the last few years doing this job at HuffPo. I'm going to bring in my own past and history. I'm going to create a fictional, you know, bring it into contemporary times, create fictional characters. I put them in Chicago, the city of my birth, and certainly a city with its own identity and brand related to racial conflict, and I'm going to let them fall in love and find their equilibrium, and then I'm going to burden them with
That's
many
okay.
of these things that I had experienced and witnessed, and see if they can find their way out of it. And that's the essence of the book. I call it a socio-political love story. And that's really the genesis of it all. That's their trajectory. And when I was done with it, I really wanted to make sure I got it right. And Regina was one of the people who read it, and I was sort of terrified to give it to her because she is someone who
yeah.
does not suffer fools gladly. And she would be very, very candid with me about it if I hadn't gotten it right. And she loved it. She actually wrote an endorsement for the book that's on the back cover. And that was golden for me. That, you know, it was sort of like a gift because I so respected her perspective that I knew that if she felt I'd gotten it right, I was good to go.
Yeah, that's great. I'm glad you did it. And a lot of work obviously went into it, but it was your story to tell. And that's what I said. People should tell your stories. Don't worry about what other people are going to say. Just do what you have to do. But as you said, do your homework. Be true to the story, true to your work.
Yeah.
Talk about your, and this goes into the whole idea of process, the work that goes into it. A lot of people, you know, we have a lot of listeners to the show who are other writers, artists, or would-be aspirants who always say, like, well, how do you do it? They're always curious about the process and the inspiration. So we have your inspiration
sure.
here. What's your process like? I mean, you went through a lot of work. What's your day-to-day as a writer? Do you sit down every day and say, well, I'm going to write for 2 hours? Do you wait for
no,
the inspiration to hit you? How does it work for you?
I'm sort of an iconoclast when it comes to that. And I personally eschew all rules related to writing. I've had some of them imposed upon me as a younger writer. And I personally don't agree with the write every day, sit down and give yourself a set number of hours, stare at the blank page. I don't agree with any of that. I don't do any of that. I work on a computer. I get up in the morning. I go through my social media, answer my emails. I, you know, fiddle around. And when I start to feel like, okay, I'm ready to dig in, I start writing. And if I don't that day, I don't. And if I don't feel inspired and I don't have any ideas, I grab my, you know, my playlist on my phone, slap my headphones on and go out for a long walk, which is when I get a lot of inspiration. But when I'm in it, you know, when I get in the on the roll, you know, I can write all day and into the night and all night and not sleep and, you know, lie in bed trying to sleep as I'm writing the next chapter in my head. But I think that writing has to be organic. I don't I know many people have very strict, rigid, you know, what's the word, rituals that they apply to their own process. I don't. I basically feel that inspiration has to move me. So I do what will draw out inspiration. And oftentimes that's watching a movie or reading another book or looking at the news and seeing what provokes my ire or gets me laughing.
Yep.
And then that will lead me to want to write something. I've often come home after a power walk and sat down at the computer and wrote a full article or wrote the next two chapters of my book because I had things come to me while I was walking, ways to solve certain problems. I think that, you know, everybody has to find their own way. There's a lot of people who will give you rules and tell you you have to do things a certain way, and I don't agree or believe that. I think each writer has to find their way. But they have to be honest, too, right? Like if you're a person who says, well, I'm not going to follow that rule that says I have to sit down every day and write, and then you go 5 months without writing because you keep saying that to yourself, you need to examine and explore really how inspired to write you are at all, you know?
Exactly.
Because it's funny,
yeah.
I was in this Facebook group a couple years ago, and it was a lot of newbies. And I remember there was this one girl who kept writing about how she wanted to write a novel. She wanted to write a novel, and people would, you know, but she didn't have an idea, and people would, you know, there'd be these long comment threads of people giving her ideas, and she'd angst, and this went on for weeks and weeks. And finally, I didn't say anything, and finally I left a comment, and I said, have you ever considered that there's something else that might inspire your passion more than writing? Because I think if it's this hard for you to come up with an idea, it's possible
maybe
this
it's
not
is not
your medium. And, of course, I got rabidly attacked for saying such a terrible thing. But I honestly believe that. I don't think that you can beat an idea out of yourself. I think it emerges unfettered when you open your mind to inspiration.
I think you're right. I mean, I do creativity coaching with people, and I do writing workshops, and invariably there's always somebody in the writing workshop that will come at the beginning. They'll say, oh, I want this to be my new career. And I'm like, I don't really do it as a career. I do it as a process thing, and we'll see. You know, because I said, well, I haven't really figured out the formula for you to write the best-selling novel yet, so good luck with that one. But what we typically do is I give prompts at the beginning, and we all write something, and then we go around the room and share if we want to, and that kind of thing. And then we're open to people bringing in things. Now, this one guy who wanted a new career. This was his thing. He was a tennis pro, but he was middle age, 50s, great shape because he played a lot of tennis and it worked out a lot. Went to an Ivy League school, good education, but finally dawned on him, I want to do something else in my life. They decided I want to be a writer, which is fine, and he wrote some very interesting things in the sharing time, but he would never come in with anything. I said, what's going on? He said, well, I just can't write it. You know, I can only write when I'm in here. And I said, unless you want to pay me $150 an hour to sit with you every day, I mean, at some point you're going to have to be self-motivated. I mean, so I agree with you. Sometimes, and some people hold on to the idea, you know, for whatever reason they decided at one point they wanted to be a writer or whatever it might be. It could be something else, a painter, a singer, whatever the thing was. And they're holding on to this idea, but they're never pursuing it with any kind of
urgency.
Well, it's
because I personally think
they don't want to do it. Yeah,
well, and I think that it's like what comes first, right? When I was a young actor, when I first got to L.A., I remember the very, very first thing I did was get in this acting class, and it was all young people, and there were so many people in there that were utterly talentless, but they were absolutely convinced that they were going to be winning an Oscar. And somebody said to me, do you think you can teach people how to act? And I said, well, I think you could teach them the technique of acting, but I don't think you can teach people talent. People either have a talent in an art or they don't. Anybody can learn the technique of acting or writing or singing or, you know, they can learn the technique of it, the math of it, the framework of it. But having true talent is something innate. It is inherent in a person, and you cannot teach talent. It's either there or it isn't. And so I think, you know, I was teaching acting for a while, and I was also, you know, consulting writers, screenwriters, and book writers. And I would say there comes a point where you really have to get honest with yourself and say, is this my forte? Is this my medium? Maybe there's something else I'm better at. There's that, and there's also the thing about why are you doing it? Because I remember I was working with this one musician, and I said, what is your goal? And he said, I want to be a rock star. And I said, well, that's not a goal. That's a result, and that's not something you can predict or expect. What is your goal as an artist? And he just kept going back to that. I want to be a rock star. And I said, well, then let me just explain to you, you are not going to be able to do that because you can't control that. If you say to me, I want to write incredible songs, or I want to sing with a passion that gives people goosebumps, well, that's something we can work with. But, you know, it's like when in this writer's group, when people would say, I want to see my books up on Amazon, or I want to see my books on a shelf. And I'd say, I understand that. I do. We all understand that. But what is motivating you to write a story? That has to come from something deep in your gut and your soul and your psyche. And it's not about bookshelves and rock stars. It's about, I must tell this story because it moves me, or I feel compelled to get this out. It is something I absolutely must do. That, to me, is what has to be the very first step to any art that anybody does. There are probably plenty of people who don't agree with me. I mean, I remember when I was doing a lot of songwriting, and I would talk to a lot of Nashville songwriters who'd say, you know, we get five people in a room, and we just throw out ideas, and it... And that's fine. That's enough. That's one way of doing it. That's never been my way of doing it. For me, it's been always a much more sort of spiritual, inspirational thing.
Right. You're looking for an organic thing. Some people approach writing that way too, where they just say, "Well, I'm writing this as a commercial vehicle." I've done that sometimes, occasionally. I've been known to do that. It doesn't always pan out that way, though. By the way, some of my cash cows have not delivered a lot of cash. Let's put it that way. But there can be people who are not necessarily when you say about talent. Talent is a factor, but it's also motivation and inspiration and discipline that counts, because you can if you have some talent, you can learn how to hone it and train it, and there are definitely people, we all know them, I'm not going to mention names, they don't need publicity, who are very successful, commercially more successful than either you or I are, who are making a lot of money and they don't have that much talent. So, I mean, so it's not just that. If you just look into it whatever.
And I'll be the first to say, you know, because I'm not, you know, monetarily, you know, successful, I'm not, you know, J.K. Rowling or Stephen King. I am, you know, I'll be the first to say that this is the way it works for me. There are other people, and I even, you know, there was an article that I wrote for, I can't remember if it was for Writer's Digest or Women's women writers, women's books, but it was about listen to the voice that's your own. And in the article, I talked about two circumstances where people who were authorities in the field, one was the music business and one was the book business, who gave me advice that I did not subscribe to. I could not take it. And I walked away from both those circumstances, and somebody else would say, well, but you might have sabotaged yourself. That might have gotten you in a door, and you might have gone from there to then being able to do exactly what you wanted to do. And that may very, very well be true. And I'm very well aware of
that. What was the advice? Can you share it?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember which article it was. The first one was when I was in music, and I was getting a publishing deal with a very big company, BMG Music, which was a very big company, or I thought I was anyway. And I went in and I met with the head guy, whose name I won't mention because he's very famous. And he sat down and he started reading my lyrics out loud. And he laughed. He laughed like sort of snarkily. And he said, you know, I don't even know what this means. I don't even know what this means. He said, you know what I need from you? If I sign you, you know what I need from you? He said, you know the song, Pour a Little Sugar on Me? And I sat there. I remember I started to sweat. I actually started to get very hot, and I started to get a little queasy. And I said, you know, yeah, it's, you know, a big hair band song, is that Def Leppard or something? And I said, yeah. But that's not what I write. And he went, well, that's what I want from you. We'll sign you up. You write me some of those. And I thanked him, and I walked out, and I said to my manager, I can't do it. And my manager actually dumped me after that because he was so angry that I turned down this deal, which I found out later he was getting something out of, you know, like there was something he was going to get out of that with the catalog he had. That was one event. And the second was with my very first novel, after the Sucker Punch, after it was completely, you know, edited, content edited, formatted, everything. It was spit shined within an inch of its life. It had been through, you know, countless drafts. A lot of people had read it and given it the thumbs up. I met with this literary consultant who I thought her job was going to be to guide me to how to market it because I wanted to publish it traditionally. And it was a thing where I had to pay her a considerable amount of money to read the book and, you know, kind of advise me. She read the book, and she basically hated it and basically said to me, it needs a page one rewrite. And I was so shocked. I was just like, I felt terrible because I knew that she was going to look at me through the filter of, oh, this is a young, new writer. Well, it wasn't that young, actually. It wasn't that long ago. And she's, you know, being resistant to critique. But that wasn't it. I'd been through decades of critique at that point. I knew how to take it. I'd had my gut kicked out by directors and producers. I understood the process. This was literally saying your entire premise, your book, your character, your voice, all of it is wrong, and you need to go here. And I sat there for a long time, and we were going to do a 90-minute phone session after this, and I thought about it, and I reread my book, and I went, no, I'm not going to do it. I love this book. This book is what I want to say with this book. And I contacted her, and I said, thank you very much. I'm going to pass on the session. And I think she was really, really shocked because she was pretty high up there. And again, you know, I walked away going, have I just sabotaged myself? Not that she was going to do anything specifically for me, but by even not taking her notes. And I decided it didn't matter because the book had to be what I wanted it to be. If I wasn't going to be traditionally published, one of the perks of doing it yourself, because I ultimately didn't find an agent, is doing and saying and putting out into the world exactly the book you want to. And that's what I did. And the book went on to get tremendously positive response. It sold well. It got great reviews. It won awards. And, you know, I say to myself, would she feel differently if she read it now? And the answer is probably not. She'd probably feel exactly the same way. But that's what an artist has to, when an artist has to decide whose voice they're going to listen to. And my prescription is always listen to, you know, your handful of trusted advisors and editors and consultants. But ultimately, it comes down to your own voice. And you have to feel good about what you're hearing from yourself, and sometimes at the expense of other people who think you're wrong. and you have to believe in yourself that much. That's what I think. But I also think when you're new and you're young and you're learning, you have to listen a lot more than you do when you're several books in and you're as old as me, you know, and I'm not going to say all of it, but, you know, I've been around.
Right.
And so I think that's earned autonomy. I think you have to go through the trenches, too.
And you're in the confidence as you go. Of course, I always say, you think it gets easier, but it's always a walk in the woods and a walk in the weeds every time I start a new project. I'm like, you think you should know.
Sure.
I've done this a few times already. I've done this, you know, how many books have I written, how many plays have I written, okay. But each time you get out there and it's a new adventure. And that's the nice way of putting it.
Yes.
Sometimes it's hard. Some days it's hard. I am so much on the same page with you in terms of letting it organically happen. Like somebody asked me, are you a plotter or are you a pantser? I didn't even know what that meant. I learned what it means. It's like, do you do it at the seat of your pants or do you plot everything out?
Okay.
And I'm more of a pantser, but I have a mystery series that I wrote, and I did discover as I'm writing the mystery, I do start out organically, but then somewhere along the line, you do have to sort of plot things and plant clues and make sure.
Sure.
You know, the first mystery I wrote, I discovered at some point towards the end that I had the wrong killer. So I discovered who the real killer was, and I said, oh great, what am I going to do now? So I had to make sure everything agreed. I had to go back to make sure that all the clues were there to set up for the right. Yeah. So it was organic, though, and so I'm very much, and anything else that I write, it's all kind of, you know, it starts somewhere, and then you have to hone it. I always say, yes, things come to you. Inspiration comes, the story just comes. People always think it's, and when you talk about it, when I talk about it, some people are, oh, you're so lucky, you have all these ideas, all these characters. I said, no, you know, I always have something going on in my head. That's true. There's always a character needling me, and there's always a couple of different stories going on. And the one who wins out, the next one is going to be the person or the character or the story. It usually starts with a character for me, but whatever, the idea that's the loudest that has to be told with urgency.
Right.
Because there are also
a
lot of things, I don't know if this is true with you, I suspect it is, because there's so many things that just don't come to fruition because it's not formed enough. I have a couple of things I've backburnered, and I think I'm going to go back to it. We'll see if it happens. It's all a question of urgency, and if it does really come formed enough that you're going to run with it and be disciplined. Frankly, it's like, you know, with the world we live in now, it's cultural ADD. There's so many things going on to keep control of. I know you're very immersed in social media, and you talk about a lot of things. And I did read an article you wrote that you posted about let your candor be your brand, where you talked about it, and I've gotten some of this blowback too, where if you're out there with your political views, some people have said to you, and I've gotten this too, you don't want to tell people what your politics are. And I'm like, it's too late. I have a radio show. I've been a journalist. I'm out there. You know, they know.
Well, but I think, in that article, I think that, I think it was that article, I quoted Nina Simone, as the quote at the beginning of the article, her famous quote about art reflecting the times. And I think for me, that's exactly right. It's that I want to write books, whether, you know, fiction. I write nonfiction articles, but I don't write nonfiction books. So either nonfiction articles or fictional books, I think that I see my role as a writer, as someone who is going to reflect the times that I live in and hopefully offer some illumination and inspiration along the way, because that's just something I choose to do. You know, you can write a book that has no underlying message or no underlying illumination or theme to walk, you know, that moral to the story, and that's fine. And I've read books like that and enjoyed them thoroughly. They're absolutely perfectly wonderful in the marketplace, so I'm not disparaging that. I have always felt compelled, and I think this was the point that music publisher was trying to make, that not everybody wants that, but that is what my mission is as an artist, is that I want to tell stories that are meaningful to me, and to whatever extent they're meaningful to other people, great. You know, then I am reflecting my times and my worldview through my life experience and through my observation. And so I can't, like you, I can't not let those perspectives be known. They're known, and that's okay with me. You know, because the fact of the matter is they're imbued in my novels as well. You know, you're not going to read one of my novels and walk away wondering if I'm a right-wing Fox-watching backup. You're not. You're going to know exactly where my politics are. And that's okay with me.
Right.
I don't need to have the entire world think I'm fabulous, because I already know, because I'm in social media, that there are a lot of people who don't think I'm fabulous. And, you know, that's okay. You know,
I thought you were going to say, I already know I am fabulous.
No, but, you know, I'm talking about trolls and people on Twitter.
Yes,
you know,
of course.
I had to report somebody today, and luckily Twitter removed their account that was so vile and so violent toward me. It's shocking. It was for some political viewpoint, you know, it was kind of something probably anti-Trump, and they, you know, it was one of these, wanted me to put shard glass into parts of my body. You know, I mean, it's that kind of thing.
That's
ugly, and, you know, but at the end of the day, that's the price we pay for our candor, and that's okay with me. You know, I mean, as long as there are ways to, through, you know, the rules of social media or the rules that we live by, most people. And I'm okay with people knowing how I feel politically. That's just the way it has to
be.
Absolutely.
It's a free country. You should be. You're outspoken, and you're an artist and a commentator.
Yeah.
And so be it. You know, own it.
Yeah.
And you certainly, it's infused in this book. I mean, you have a lot of things that go on. You put these people through the mill. Believe me, I feel bad for them. But I'm not going to give away the ending. But, you know, I was.
No, please don't.
But no, I won't.
Well, because a lot of people, you know, that contacted me during the middle of the reading, and they would say, oh, my God, you know, what's going to happen? Are they going to, you know, but no, I'm not telling you. You know, you got to read the whole book because it takes you down some dark turns and some twisty paths. And that's, you know, that's what it should, that's what a book should do in whatever genre it is. It should take you.
I'm very honest. I think a lot of those feelings that the characters had, too, were sometimes infuriating, but also very believable, very credible. That's why I think you get the thumbs up from your, sensitivity readers or people who, you know, because it's true. Those are kind of, they ring true, the emotions, the reactions on both sides.
Good. Thanks, Well, that was, again, very important to me. I mean, I haven't talked a lot since the book came out. I haven't, you know, the book events that I've gone to have been predominantly white people have shown up. And I'm sort of hopeful that it will, you know, merge into our culture at large and start being read by people of all different demographics.
Yeah.
And I will be very interested to hear how it hits other people as well outside of the white community. And because, you know, someone said to me at a book event the other day, did you write this? Who did you write this for? Did you write this for what readers did you write this for? And I said, well, I wrote this for anybody. I wrote this for everybody. But I said, my hope is that black readers will read it and see some of their experience and their lives reflected honestly through the filter of my observation and experience, right? It's obviously, you know, one woman had said to my friend Regina, we don't need her to tell our stories. And Regina said, this isn't our story. This is her story. She gets to tell the story, and she told it right. And I appreciated that because I'm sure that there will be some of that. I've had a few reviewers say, initially I was uncomfortable reading this book, knowing that a white author was writing this, because it's told very much through the perspective of both the black male protagonist and the white female protagonist. So it's not told through her point of view. It's told through both their points of view.
Right.
So you go into his life and his family and his friends just as you do hers. And there are some people who think that that was very daring of me to do in the current environment. And maybe it is, but I felt like it was just paying homage, was honoring the characters that I had created. And it was honoring their journey and their relationships and their interactions with each other. It had to be told that way. And so my hope is black readers will read it and see some part of their life and experience reflected, and that white writers will read it and... If I was going to say, is it tilted more towards white readers, I would say only because I think white readers can read the experiences of black people in the news or in media or whatever and go, wow, that happens out there. That happens to them, you know. And they can feel passionate or compassionate or empathetic about it, but it's still somewhere out there, right? Because we white people with our white privilege don't have those experiences. So I want them to read this book and feel it move from out there into in here, into my psyche, into my emotional realm, and feel that experience along with these characters, because we don't typically, right? We don't typically feel.
No, we don't.
We observe it. We might have empathy for it. We might march with it. We see ourselves as allies. But even the most liberal of whites, and many of whom that, you know, I used things that were said to me by people that who saw themselves as liberal whites that were insensitive and caustic and ridiculous. And yet
yeah.
they thought it
yeah,
was just a joke, you know, or they
yeah.
thought it was,
yeah.
you know, no big deal. And so I want white readers to read it and gain some honest, visceral illumination in a way that maybe they don't get from reading the news, because fiction has a way of climbing into our psyche, into our heart and our mind in a way that's very different than reading nonfiction. And I hope that by feeling that and having empathy and being invested in these characters, they'll walk away with a better understanding about it. And so that's who I wrote
it for. You're so right about that. That the
yeah.
way I often say this, that you can do a lot more in fiction and drama, music, to you know to get the to illuminate and to bring up all those visceral feelings and touch
Absolutely.
People in a way that you really can't in an article or a commentary on a radio show or a cable TV show or something like that. So,
or a nonfiction
so, yeah.
book. You know, you can read a nonfiction
book yeah.
about
yeah.
being an ally or the black experience,
right.
and you there's a distance that you have with nonfiction. But I think with fiction, because you get invested in the characters, right? You become
exactly,
emotionally involved with them. It hits you in different centers of yourself,
yeah.
right? And it,
yeah.
I think, and because of that, ideas and themes and morals and illuminations enter into your psyche in a very different way, and they typically stick more because you have an emotional connection to them that you don't get
exactly.
from reading nonfiction. I think that's very
you're
true.
You're more invested, and also you let your defenses down a little bit, too. You can sort of
yeah.
But you don't necessarily,
yeah.
when you pick up the book, necessarily know what's going to be coming at you. You know, whereas you're
right.
on a cable TV show, or if you read, I mean, some I would say some nonfiction books, if it's a memoir or a biography, sometimes might hit you that too, because you get invested in the person's life. But certainly,
well, it's funny because I think about certain books that I read at certain points of my life that were fiction, that I, for whatever reason, they struck me so hard that even to this day, maybe sometimes decades later, I think about those books all the time, you know, whether it's, you know, To Kill a Mockingbird, which is such a classic, or even Little Drummer Girl, which was a book that I read, you know, just great fiction, and yet it illuminated to me that conundrum in the Middle East in a way that I had never heard it illuminated, and it shifted my thinking. It opened me up to that whole situation in a way that I had never experienced before, and that was fiction, you know, that was a great
okay.
tale, and that, to me, is what fiction has the power of doing, and it stays with you, and you carry it with you, and I think that's an incredibly powerful artistic gift that fiction writers get to give readers, and certainly I feel honored to, if I offer that to anybody, I feel like that's a wonderful thing.
Well, I think you've done it with this book, that's for sure, so congratulations.
Oh.
I know it was a labor of love and a lot of intensity, and as you've described, a lot of homework going into it as well. So I'm glad you did it.
Yeah.
I'm glad you didn't back off and you know, crawl away when you read that article or that comment about
yeah.
something you didn't write about a black character, because that would be, that's a shame. I really
yeah.
don't think people should tell other people what they can write, because stories come to who's ready to tell. That's what I always say. If I don't write this, some of these things are back burner. Somebody, you know, another muse will catch on and deliver it to somebody else. You know, it's like,
yeah.
So
well,
yeah,
I don't think
very,
it's the artist's job to censor their voice. You know, I think it's the artist's job
yep.
to have as wide a palette as possible. And if the media or the marketplace wants to get busy doing that, well, then the artist has to figure out how to overcome that and how to respond, you know. And I certainly understand, because I have read a few books, I have to say, that since all of this came to my awareness about cultural appropriation and white authors not writing white characters, I made a point of reading several books that were written by white authors that had black characters, and some of them were not good. You know, they were not sensitive, and they were not well done. And I thought, well, if I read that book as a black person, I would be like, what the hell? You know, I mean, what are you doing? And so, you know, it also just comes down to quality. You know, what is the quality of the book?
Well, of course.
What is the quality of the writer, and what is the quality of everything? So, But, you know, I mean, I think writers are not there to censor themselves. They're there to write their stories, and if they put out junk and people don't like it, then they're going to have to face that. If they put out beautiful work and the media goes crazy because they wrote a black character, well, then they got to deal with that. I mean, that's just the way it goes. But I'm not going to not write what I feel is important for me to write because somebody told me I'm not allowed to do that. I'm not going to do
that. Well, it's also people who say, you know, men can't write female characters, women can't write men, you know, or voice, the voice of a female protagonist, or you can have a male protagonist, and you do have a male protagonist and a female protagonist, and you channel your...
Well, and if you remember, we talked, the last time we talked was about Hysterical Love, my second book, which is all written from the first-person point of view of a young guy, of a 33-year-old man. And there were so many people like, wow, what was that like? How did you do that? I'd be like, well, have you ever asked the millions of male writers who have female protagonists how they got into the female mind? I mean, it's that's just patriarchal sexism, that question, you know, because, you know, men have been writing whatever characters they want from time immemorial. And, you know, all I said was, well, because I'm a human being on this earth and I interact with men every day and I pay attention, and I have brothers, and I married to a man, and I raised a man, and I have lots of male friends, and how hard is it to figure this out? You know, it's not that hard. You know, how did you write about a Martian? You know?
Yeah,
how did you write
about,
you know, aliens from another planet? You know, it's called imagination, too.
Exactly. It's called imagination. It's called voice. It's called inspiration. All of those things.
Right.
And you write what you want to write, and then worry about, as you said, all this other garbage later. But make it as good as you can make it. I think that's the key. And
let me just state this really clearly. I said at the beginning, and I think this is really true, is that there's no question that there is inequity in the publishing business, that voices of diversity are not represented fairly in it, and that needs to be fixed, and that needs to be done by publishers. You know.
Right.
That needs to be done by publishers and media, giving those books attention, and that's their job. It's not the job of other writers to not write so that they, you know, that feels more equitable. That's not how you solve that problem. So, but it's a very real problem that needs to be solved.
We can't solve it all, but we can recommend good books, and this is a good book, and I definitely recommend folks pick it up because
thank
I think
you
you'll
so
be moved.
Much.
I think there's, as I said, there's the heart of the story. It's a love story. What did you call it? A socio-political love story. I like that.
I know.
So much
I
in
like
here, and there's a lot of stuff about what's going on in the world today, and some of it is eye-opening. Some of it we do see on the news, but as you said, you're giving it a personal prism and real characters and, ordinary people, but, you know, solid people who get swept up in stuff when they have no reason to do it other than being profiled and being harassed for really no good reason. It's just
bad
in a way, but it does reflect our times. Congrats on the book. Are you off to another? I know you're busy on social media and you're talking about politics, and I'm not going to get into the whole 2020 race with you. I know our listeners will get into it a little bit when we let you go, but what's your... I mean, you can if you want to, but I don't want to ensnare you any longer. But what are you up to now? Are you into another project, or are you just promoting this one now heavily?
Well, right now, you know, generally the month after a book comes out, there's a lot of, you know, you want to take as much, you want to stir up as much attention as possible. So I still have three more book events that I'm doing. I'm going up to San Francisco tomorrow. I'm doing a book event at Books, Inc. in Opera Plaza in downtown San Francisco tomorrow night at 7. And then next week I'm going to Chicago where I'm doing a private event. And then I'm going to be at the Bookseller on May 3rd, which is a Friday night, 7 o'clock, for all my Chicago folks. And so, and then once that's done, there might be a few private things, but, you know, we'll see where it all goes from there. I've started a fourth book. I haven't been working on it lately because it's just been so, you know, immersed in this launch and all the, you know, work related to, you know, I've been writing a lot of articles, going out in related to the book and related to these issues. But once this tour is done, which will be done at the beginning of May, you know, I'll step back and kind of see. I've got a couple of other, I've got a play that I need to rewrite. I've got my fourth book, like I said, that I've actually begun and I'm pretty far into that I need to continue because it's got a time frame to it because it's a fun story about it's an interesting story about a former 80s rock singer who whose adult daughter posts her music on the internet, and it takes off, and it slams her into this area of her life that she had wanted to forget for various mysterious reasons. And so I have some time issues because if too many years go by and I don't write it, you know, given that the 80s will be like decades and decades ago, you know, my people
will
bump
be
too
it up to
old,
the 90s.
You know, the characters will be too old to be in this story, so I got to get it out pretty quick.
Are you doing
then,
any more
you know,
of your singer-songwriter stuff? Are you doing any more music?
Yes, my band, Sixth and Third, we're going to be doing a benefit this summer for the Democrats, the Democratic Party. We're all Democrats, luckily, makes things easier. So we're going to start working on that. We don't do enough with that because everybody's so busy, and one of our main players is in college, so he's in college, and then we've got people doing, you know, my brother is, Tom Amandus is a busy actor and director, so he's, you know, it's just hard to get everybody together as much as I personally would like to, but yeah, we're going to be doing something this summer.
Well, you're pretty busy yourself, Lorraine, so.
I am, but I think I have more time than a lot, you know, I'm more flexible, so those are all things that are happening, and you know, I want to get back into my photography again. I've really backburnered that, and you know, continue to write articles on my blog, and I've still even got my foot in the acting. I had just auditioned for something the other day, which I didn't get, which I was disappointed, but I don't do that very much anymore either, but I did do a show a couple years ago in San Diego, and it kind of whet my appetite again, so I'm kind of, you know, I stick my foot in wherever I can find an outlet that has roles for someone like me, and so we'll
that's artistic.
That up. What was that?
That's artistic. You have those artistic balls in the air, that's for sure.
I do. That's, you know, I don't know why it is that way, but that is the way it's always been. So that's what I do.
So if folks want to find out more about the book, you have a website, right? It's LorraineDevonWilkie.com. Right, I'll post the link for you along with the podcast when it becomes available and people can check
Great.
It out. Follow you on Twitter. I know you're very busy on social media. I'm sorry you got slammed by a troll, but you rose above it.
It happens all the time.
It happens, I know. I really appreciate it. Always a great time talking with you, Lorraine. Wish you the best. Congrats on the book, The
Thank
Alchemy
you.
Of Noise. Lorraine Delvin Wilkie is the guest, and I'm sure we'll talk to you again. We'll see you around
Thanks,
social media, that's
I
for
really
sure.
I really appreciate being on. I always enjoy talking to you.
Thank you.
All right, take care, my friend.
Lorraine Devin
okay.
Wilkie. You too, take care. We will definitely post the details, LorraineDevinWilkie.com. Details along with the podcast when it becomes available. Reach out. It is the Amy Beth Arkley Show. Twitter, AB Wright. Phone line, 347-857-4505. Facebook page, pop in the chat box, too.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find. Don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate.
You know we've got to find a way
to bring some love and kiss here today. Oh, pick it light and pick it fast. Punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see. Oh, what's going on? What's going on? Yeah, what's going on? Oh, what's going on?
Right now.
Right on.
On the Eagle Good Dark Way show for Donnie. Appreciate the kind words via the PopNet chat box and the late, great Marvin Gaye. What's going on, indeed? Hey, thanks again going out to Lorraine Devon Wilkie, wonderful author, singer, songwriter, actress, renaissance gal all around. The new novel is out. It's called The Alchemy of Noise. Pick it up. You'll be immersed in a what she called the socio-political love story. It's charged, it's tender, it's passionate, and there's lots in there about what's going on in the world today. I think you'll be illuminated. Check it out. I think you'll enjoy it. It's called The Alchemy of Noise. I'll post her details for her website where you can find out more, along with the podcast when it becomes available. Don't forget, all the shows are archived as such. Follow the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show wherever you get your podcasts, from Mixcloud to Stitcher, iTunes to NetNow. Select editions, too, on the Arts Radio Network, PopNet, and New York Talk Radio. We're all aboard. More outlets coming every day. We love it. All roads lead back to our website, amybetharkaway.com. That's ARKAWY.com, indeed. So in the news, I know lots of folks were talking about yesterday about the Mueller report, of course. We have the 2020 race getting ever more populated. Seth Moulton, the Democratic rep from Massachusetts, who at one point tried to challenge Nancy Pelosi for the speakership, he's in the race. And we hear tell that Joe Biden will finally make it official on Thursday. Are you in? Who are you in with? Last night they had that big town hall deal with a whole bunch of candidates. So we'll get into that as time permits, or we'll do it another day with Bernie Sanders and some controversial comments he made about voting rights. But let's not go there now, because I want to take on this thing about Jared Kushner. Crazy, right? Jared Kushner, the son-in-law, finally speaks. He rarely does so in public. Was at a Time magazine event, and his comment about the Mueller probe was, it is more distracting and damaging to the country than the little bit of interference with Russia, which pretty much he swatted away like a fly, just was a couple of Facebook ads. Clearly, Jared did not read the report. And this is why I believe Congress needs to move on, because a lot of people aren't going to read the report. But they indicated it, and I haven't read all of it, but I read a fair chunk of it. And I'm still in the first section where Mueller could not prove or say that he could not prove a criminal conspiracy with Russia, but he certainly said there was sweeping and systematic interference, and that the Trump Organization benefited from and sought to benefit from even illegally attained, illicitly attained information from the Russians. Whether it panned out or not, they tried, and somehow this doesn't rise to the level of criminality. I'm not a lawyer. I don't know. He's a prosecutor. He's got a great reputation, and I'll defer to that, of course, but there was still a lot of garbage going on, to say the least. And he talks about unscrupulous, unethical behavior. So to just swat it away like nothing, it's at our own peril, because, by the way, they're still doing it now. So whether the Trump Organization was involved or not, and it looks like they were, they probably don't care, because they want to be involved when they do it again for 2020. So unless we're going to really have a blue consensus candidate, blue no matter who, kids, as I said, come together behind somebody at some point. We have the primary to go through, and it's very populated, and I get it, but let's not eviscerate each other, shall we? Because otherwise we're going to get four more years of a criminal enterprise, and that's pretty much what we have. So for Jared Kushner to actually sit there and say, it's no big deal, nothing to see here, and people are going to buy it, and some people are. The Trumpian people are buying it, that's for sure. But they can't do it with just the Trumpians, the hardcore cult. They have to have other people. So some people are going to have to just say, we're not going to vote for this guy, that's for sure. So what are you saying? Juana says Jared Kushner is pushing the Putin false narrative, re the Trump-Russia deal. This is almost as harmful as Kushner giving MBS info on why, when, and where to murder and chop up a journalist. Ouch. Horrible. His comment about the Khashoggi thing, by the way, was also disgusting, where he said, well, I told him to offer the greatest transparency. I mean, again, coded language. He's talking to people over WhatsApp, all this kind of stuff, while they're still denigrating poor Hillary Clinton over the email server nonsense. I mean, it's just crazy. MR says Jared Kushner's remarks about the investigation being worse than the Russian interference has spoken like the idiot criminal daddy. Like the idiot criminal daddy had to buy his way into Harvard for. But they did it legally, not the admission scandal, right? It's too much. All these things sort of converge and collide with each other. You know, I always say, when one scandal goes away, something else will come and fill the void. This has always been the way, and now we're so overpopulated with so much stuff in the universe that it just gets crazy. Maxine says, well, if anyone wondered why the CIA and FBI didn't want to give Kushner security clearance in the first place, this should tell you why. The kind of talk that he's offering covers for the Russians makes a second attack on the country much more likely. That is what I'm saying. Be careful, kids, because we could be in for it, that's for sure. Patricia on Facebook says, Jared is of the same mobbed-up, grifting type of family as the Trumps. Daddy even did a stint in the federal pen. That's true. Jared Kushner's dad did do a little time in jail.
So it's, in fact, Chris Christie was the one who put him in jail, which is why Chris Christie couldn't get the gig as the vice president or the chief of staff. And he's better for it. They're trying to now malign Don McGahn, who was the White House counsel, who probably helped Trump stay out of further trouble because he wouldn't obey his orders. Though Trump yesterday said, when somebody asked him about it, one of the reporters, he said, everybody obeys me, or nobody disobeys me, something like that. I mean, you're talking about delusional at a level that is pathological, that's for sure. But Congress, what are they waiting on? They're so worried about, what are they worried about, really? Are they worried about the outcome of 2020 if they do impeach him? I mean, I'm thinking maybe the field of contenders are concerned because they think it's going to be easier to beat Trump than if Trump got out of the way and they would have to deal with either Pence or somebody else that would come out a stronger candidate from the Republican side. Maybe that's true, but it probably won't all be said and done by then anyway, and he's going to hang on for dear life because he's going to barricade himself in that White House. Otherwise, he might face prosecution. The fact that he's president is what's keeping him out of jail, which is just so twisted on a level that it's hard to even wrap your head around. If you ask me. Twitter, AB Writes, phone line 347-857-4505, Facebook page, PopNet chat box, Darcy on PopNet. Hey, great interview, really enjoyed it. Very lively conversation. I'm going to check out Lorraine's book. There you go, Lorraine. See, I'm making you fans one at a time. Pearly on Twitter, good conversation as always, AB. I'm going to check out the book too. Lorraine has some good thoughts. All right, indeed. Check it out. I think you're going to enjoy it. And I think the Congress has got to check out what the Constitution means. Back into the archives. Trudy came up with this one. It's a classic. From the great Dickie Goodman. I'll give a listen.
We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, do establish this Constitution for the United States of America.
Let's get it on, baby.
Article 1. Congress shall consist of a Senate, a House of Representatives, and... Article 2, the President shall hold his office 4 years, and together with the Vice President, in case of the removal of the President from office, he shall be, before he enter on the execution of his office, the President shall take the following oath.
I love you, and that's all I know.
The President and Vice President shall be removed from office on impeachment for and conviction of,
trying to make a living and doing the best I can.
Article 3. The judges of the Supreme Court shall hold their offices until they be,
knock, knock, knocking on heaven's door.
Article 4. The citizens of each state shall be entitled to, Article 5. The Congress shall propose amendments to this Constitution.
Yes, you can.
Amendment 1. Congress shall make no law... Could you keep it down a little? Amendment 1. Congress shall make no law respecting an established... Could you keep it down a little? Amendment 1. Congress shall make no... Would you keep it down? Amendment 1. Congress shall make no law... Would you shut up?
Congress shall make all the
simpler time, when the American dream of one presidential candidate, Gary Hart, was derailed due to an affair and a little ride on a boat called the Monkey Business. Remember that? And now we have a grifter, a sexual predator, a full-out criminal, and, yeah, maybe he's not an official agent or asset of the Russian government, but he certainly is a useful idiot. Donald J. Trump in the White House. Amazing how times have changed. That's Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young on the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show, and of course Dickie Goodman, who did all those great 70s, 80s, and beyond mashup songs about the Constitution. It's your duty, Congress, to proceed at least with inquiries. I don't understand why they're so afraid of the I word, impeachment. I guess they're really afraid that maybe it'll be easier to beat Donald Trump, but of course Hillary thought that too. For re-election than if they got somebody else. It's going to take a long time to get through that little morass. But we've got to start, because the thing is, people are not going to read that report. That's the problem. And maybe a lot of these people aren't going to be turned either. I get it. But if you see some of the testimony from Mueller and McGahn and other people who I think will be compelling, people watched the Michael Cohen testimony. I don't know if people were swayed or not. But Trump's actually, since the report was released, the redacted report last week, Trump's approval rating has dipped even lower than usual. So that's true. And again, I'm loath to rely on polls, but I do know one thing. The hardcore Trumpians will disregard it and they will go out there like a cult. That's true. They will just go and do it and vote for him. So we have to counteract that by drumming up a lot of inspiration and a lot of enthusiasm for whoever winds up winning that nomination. So no matter who, I'm loath to like criticize anybody, but you got to take it on. And last night they had those town halls on CNN, back to back to back, from Klobuchar to Buttigieg and everybody in between. Well, a few people in between, I shouldn't say. It was Kamala Harris, Elizabeth Warren, and Bernie. Elizabeth Warren actually was very formidable, I thought, last night. And what I saw, I only saw smatterings of each one, so I can't say that I saw the whole thing. But she is just not, for whatever reason, she doesn't have the momentum. At one point, she was thought of as a front runner. There's something about her style, perhaps, that annoys people. She had that whole kerfuffle with the Pocahontas nonsense with the DNA results and Trump and everything. I don't know if that will linger and cause a problem. I'm not sure what it is about her that why she doesn't have traction. But she was very formidable last night, I thought. And one of the things, and I didn't get into this with Lorraine because we kept her for so long anyway, and I didn't want to ensnare her for more time, but I know she's very big on, I think she's supporting Kamala Harris, I'm not really sure, but I know she wants to see a woman as a nominee. And I would like to see a woman if we can pull it off and if it's the right person. I just don't want to feel that steadfast that it has to be. On the other hand, the narratives of why women are not getting as much traction or seems to have as much traction might have to do with the media narratives. It's still early in the game, and there's so many people. We'll see how it all plays out indeed. But I know yet last week I had a conversation with a gentleman, an older gentleman, who somebody else we were talking and somebody they were complaining about Beto O'Rourke, who got a lot of attention at first and now has moved on to Buttigieg. The women aren't getting the attention. They said, well, maybe the women are just not that interesting, was this gentleman's comment. And my thing is, well, really, is it they're not interesting, or it's because the people that are driving the narrative, the people behind the scenes in the media, are still largely men? Largely white men who are driving this discussion. So they glommed on to Beto O'Rourke as a great figure for a while, and now it's on to Mayor Pete as the next great savior and anti-Trumpian candidate. I thought about it, and I said, well, that'll be really interesting if we could we could break a barrier by having we had the first black man could win with Obama, and now we could have the first gay man could win. But those are still going to come before we actually get a woman. And again, it could be just the person, and you do need the right person, I agree. And people argued about Hillary wasn't the right person, that's why I didn't vote for her. Those people who didn't vote for Hillary, I think that was an excuse, because I think some people it's not just Hillary, I think they don't want to admit the fact that they don't want to vote for a woman. And by the way, some of those people are women, which is really frustrating to me. So I would love to see it if we could do it, and we're not really going to change course and believe that it can happen if we don't pick somebody, which I also agree with. But I don't know what's going to happen. It's a long way to come, and we'll see if Warren or Harris, I know Gillibrand is in there, and Tulsi Gabbard, who I think probably doesn't have much of a chance. But again, who the heck knows at this point? Who the heck knows? I know Marianne Williamson doesn't have a chance. They gave her a town hall last week, though, which I thought was pretty peculiar, but whatever. What's your take? Twitter, AB Wright's phone line, 347-857-4505. Bernie making news yesterday, of course, when he said that he believes that convicted felons, even while in prison, should be able to vote. And a lot of people he was getting a lot of ire for that, because somebody posed the question, even if it's like the Boston Marathon bomber, and he said, yeah. But the truth is, Vermont and Maine both allow people in prison to vote because it's part in the Constitution. It's up to the states to do that. Now, I do believe everybody should have the right to vote once they're out of prison, have done their time, and now in some, a lot of states, you still can't do that. It's disenfranchisement, but more and more states you are allowed once you're finished with parole or whatever it is. So I'm not sure where I stand on that, but I guess that's where the perspective that he's coming from. That seems too extreme for a lot of people. Buttigieg, they asked him about it. I think Kamala Harris was kind of on the fence, and the comments that people made about her was that she was too cautious, and her comment for things that she didn't really have a solid answer for was, we need to have a conversation about that. I think that's okay for now. I think eventually she's going to have to come up with answers for these things, of course. But if you're not sure yet, you want to, you know, you don't want to step on a landmine. She already stepped on a landmine with the Medicare for All question some weeks back when she first had a town hall, and then she had to kind of walk it back because, it, you know, if it's ideally she likes it, and ideally most people probably like it, but you have to go through a process to get there. What are you going to do with the insurance companies and people who do like their insurance now and all of those questions? So all these questions are more complicated, so I think it's an okay and acceptable answer at this stage of the game to be cautious. She was pretty outspoken about certain things, like she's going to have an executive order on background checks if Congress doesn't approve it for guns, things that are, don't seem that radical in my mind, but for some people maybe are. You know, there you have it. But I just think it's fascinating because I think her narrative and I think her charisma, by the way, I think she could, of the candidate, well, Klobuchar did a good job too, actually, I should say. She was, and she's more middle of the road, so if you want the moderates, we'll see how it goes. Everybody has to come out in the primary. So if you're a middle of the road person, don't say, I'm not going to bother to vote. Vote, because there are more people who are moderate than there are extremely on the left end of the spectrum. So go out and vote. Let's see how it goes. Everybody has to show up to vote in the primary, and everybody has to show up to vote on election day because that's the only way we're going to wind up doing it. At least that's my take on it. What's yours? Twitter, AB Wright, phone line 347-857-4505. Kiwi says my top pick running for POTUS right now is Elizabeth Warren. She's got grit. She's got intelligence, her stances, her solutions, and her integrity. Since it's early, I'm also impressed with Amy Klobuchar, Kamala Harris, and a few of the men, too. I like that spirit. See, the girls are shining, but we're not giving them the... They are interesting, by the way. We're not giving them the narrative and the traction they deserve. But we'll see. Haven't heard much about Beto lately either because Mayor Pete has taken on this rock star status all of a sudden. And by the way, he doesn't have that many particular devotion to policies quite yet. Anderson Cooper, I believe, asked him about that last night. And he said, well, we don't want to get bogged down in minutia. First, you have to validate our virtues, I think is what he said. So he's got a good way of speaking. I like him. I do. I think he's got a good style. I have to say, I've been watching him. I thought he was such a breath of fresh air when I first learned about him. They've given him so much airtime, he's almost like wearing out his welcome to me already, but that doesn't mean anything. I mean, we can get another second steam, another wave, because other people will come and go. It also, he's risen in the polls so much where he's like number three or four behind Biden and Bernie, or Bernie and Biden, depending on the polls, that now they're digging up research about him. So you'll start hearing about things that are happening not so great. Not everything's perfect in South Bend, apparently. He fired an African-American police chief. There was supposedly a scandal. There's going to be some things that will be coming out because he's in it now. So when he's in it, they're going to go after him, that's for sure. Conservative Not Crazy says the field of POTUS 2020 Democrats continue their bruising battle for the chance to be the next president of Massachusetts. Well, you know, there are people you got to contend with, and it's true. You got to try to sway over some of those swing voters, but you can't rely on it. You can't be who you're not. Just to be all things to all people. We just have to remember it's a big country, and hopefully you can get more than 46% of the vote. I mean, that's what Donald Trump got. He just won a couple of key states, which, by the way, were states that were targeted by Paul Manafort giving polling data to Kilimnik. So how that wasn't part of this conspiracy, I don't know. They used it in Wisconsin and Michigan and Minnesota and Pennsylvania, I believe. So interesting, those swing states that, yeah, Trump eked out a victory. So put that in your pipe and smoke it. Bernie or Buster's, who voted for Jill Stein, or sat home in those states. It's a little crazy, if you ask me. It's still Bernie all the way for Doug. He says Bernie's got the move, and he's got the traction, he's got the money, he's got the momentum. Well, we'll see what happens, indeed. As I said, I'm not a big burner, but if he gets the nomination, I'm voting for him. That's the way it goes. Twitter, AB Wright, phone line 347-857-4505. A few minutes left here on our Tuesday, April 23rd, get-together. Facebook page and PopNet chat box open. And, you know, we spent so much time talking about Lorraine Devon Wilkie. Fascinating conversation about her new book, about a lot of things, but highlighting her new book, The Alchemy of Noise, which I do recommend. And she does so many different things, which is fascinating, too. She's a singer-songwriter. She's an actress, a journalist, very busy on social media. I see her bump up against her a lot on social media. I don't have quite. I do. I'm immersed in social media, as you know, too, but I don't have time around the clock. I just can't. We do so many of the radio shows, and I'm like, okay, gotta go. But she's into it. And creativity, once you get started, whether it's one endeavor or several endeavors, once you get going, it's sort of like eating peanuts. You can't stop yourself. So get going. And when the Inspiration of Action Challenge works for folks, I really love it. Holly today in Massapequa, Long Island, that's not too far from us, is our challenge shout-out. She says, yes, I am working on a memoir. I'm also working on poetry and painting. I got started with the challenge over a year ago. You really gave me a kick in the keister, as you would say. I do say that. And it has worked. I love it. I'm enjoying it, and I am working more with more conviction than I've had in a long time. Thank you. Well, thank you, Holly. I appreciate your kind words and your heartfelt words. Keep at it. Keep going, because that's really the point. It's to get you connected with your inner artist that might have been neglected or been dormant for so many years. Let's reconnect. Let's do it. If the Inspiration to Action Challenge has worked for you, I'd love to give you a shout-out because you deserve it because you're putting in hard work to get that work done, I know. But you're also spurring each other on, other people to say, hey, I'm going to try it because you got to have some kind of permission to get started and get going. So by all means, please reach out to the website. It's amybetharkawi.com. If you need a creative kick in the keister, let's start a conversation. The first one's on me. I'll give you a primer on the challenge, some other tips and tricks to get you in a more creative mood. And while you're at the website, you can peruse my stories, the Eliza Gordon Mysteries, some other goodies are up for grabs. You can chime in, too, with your guest suggestions, big story, and forgotten 45 requests, links to the podcast, one-stop shopping. It's amybetharkawi, A-R-K-A-W-I.com. And we will get you in the mix. And speaking of Lorraine Devon Wilkie, she had one time, I guess, sent me her one of her older CDs. Got some great music, good sound. So here's one. It's called It's Not Over. Lorraine Devon Wilkie, I mean, it's a dark wish. I know, it's here, right, Jody? Here we go.
Feel the heartbeat of the life you leave behind. left behind her was 2,000 miles away. A singing boy pick up that fiddle, who and play that steel guitar, who and find yourself a lady, who and dance. Stopped to wonder who if he'd see her again. It was a private conversation. No one heard him say that girl he left behind was 2,000 miles away. He just sang, boy, pick up that fiddle, who and play that steel guitar, who and find yourself a lady, who and dance right where you are. It was a private conversation. No one heard her say. It was a private conversation. No one heard her say. It was a private conversation.
Stopping by. And Lorraine Devon Wilkie from her Songwriter Archives, Singer-Songwriter Archives, It's Not Over. Check out her new book, The Alchemy of Noise. I think you'll like it. Details at her website, LorraineDevonWilkie.com. I will post the link along with the podcast when it becomes available. So stick around for all of that. Hey, thank you so much for joining us. TCS crew, Trudy and Aurora in the booth, MLA headquarters, for keeping us moving. Really appreciate it. And you can connect on social media. Friend me on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. Our producer, Trudy Hart, is at Radio Trudy. I am at AB Writes. The Brain Trust bookers of The View yesterday for Earth Day, belated Earth Day, huh? Who they book? Senator Mike Lee, the climate-denying senator with that cartoonish presentation. His big solution to climate change and everything else, by the way, have more kids. Let's overpopulate the planet. What can I tell you? Hey, drive safe, play nice, dream big. Please come back and see us. Mercy, mercy me. Leave you with Marvin Gaye on the Amy Beth Arkley Show. Take care. I love you all.
Whoa. Oh, mercy, mercy me. from the north and south and
east. Oh, mercy, mercy me. All things ain't what they used to be. No, no. Oil wasted on the oceans and upon our seas. Fish full of mercury. Radiation underground and in the sky. Animals and birds who live nearby all the night. Oh, mercy, mercy, me. All things and what they used to be. What about this overcrowded land? How much more will you from me? Can't you stand?